beginning of our theological reflection on the place of women in society, church, and ministry, we are pleased to have with us this evening Dr. Margaret Horton, who is with the Malcolm Bliss Mental Health Center. Her vita has a rather formidable list of experiences and accomplishments, a few of which I will point out. She is a graduate of Washington University with the PhD in January of 1970. Bob Smith put the dissertation title in the spectrum, if you will have noted, and I'm sure it impressed everybody. I won't repeat it because nobody knows what it means. It doesn't mean anything. All right. She is presently serving at Malcolm Bliss, also as adjunct professor of psychology at Lindenwood College and instructor in medical psychology at Washington University Medical School. A member of the ACLU, of the Association for Human Rights, and the Association for Women in Psychology. And as she noted in her letter, I'm also assisting some women in understanding auto mechanics and the repairing of automobiles. That by way of avocation, I suppose. Dr. Horton has indicated to me that that rather formidable title which we've been using on the development and implications of sex role stereotypes is not quite the title she chooses to use tonight. So we'll just wait and find out what title you choose to use. We say welcome to our campus, and we're anxious to hear what you have to say. Dr. Horton.
I took my title from what you gave me, Women in Society. I chose to talk generally about that rather than specifically about sex role stereotypes. I'd like to keep my remarks relatively brief because I don't like to talk at people. I'd prefer to talk with them. So I think I'll probably read this for about 25 minutes or so, and then I'd like to talk back and forth, questions and answers, whatever. In order to talk meaningfully about women in society, you first have to decide what society you're talking about. Conditions have varied a great deal from time to time, from place to place. In general, as everybody knows, women have a lower status than men. But the relative distance between them differs a great deal, depending on where and when you're talking about. If we're going to look at different societies, let's take a look at the requirements for a stable social structure. In much the same way that individual organisms are designed to assure the survival of the species, so too does a society place its own survival above the welfare of any given individual. Our present social structure is an extremely complex one in which the means for obtaining food, shelter, clothing, medical care, education, and emotional satisfaction are only a few of the processes which are regulated. However, this multiplicity of regulated enterprises can be reduced to two absolute essentials. One of these is a means for obtaining food, the other is a means for guaranteeing continued reproduction. Of course, any society that confined itself to these two variables would remain primitive, but it would remain, or it could, rather. In fact, this was essentially the state of affairs in the initial stages of human evolution. In the Miocene epoch, our ancestors were brachiating primates. That is, they lived in the treetops, they traveled by swinging from limb to limb, rather than living on the jungle floor and walking. Unfortunately, the jungle climate's antithetical to the preservation of fossils, so our evidence about their social situation is necessarily derived from physical anthropology and comparison with present-day species, which must respond to the same environmental conditions. Responsibility for the care of the young undoubtedly rested with the female, primarily, and probably secondarily with the group. There are a few species in which the care of the young rests with the male or with a mated pair, But these are things like seahorses. The seahorse carries the eggs for a while, the young. Some fish have joint care of the young. Birds have joint care of the young. No primates do. Paternity was unknown, although more or less permanent pair bonds may have existed between males and females. Therefore, the young were identified with the mother. This may have not been a fair system, but at least it ensured that the young were cared for through a relatively lengthy period of dependence. Nature's not interested in justice, only survival. Care of the young was probably not too onerous a task because food was plentiful. In a gathering economy like this one, with a plentiful food supply, there's no reason for subordination of the female to the male. Furthermore, in the treetops, there was excellent natural protection from predators, so the other principal justification for male dominance was absence. In contemporary primates, species which live in the treetops display no difference in size between male and female, while species that live on the forest floor, which is a more hostile environment, males are considerably larger than females. Gibbons, for example, the male and female both weigh approximately 13 pounds, but baboons, which are on the floor and out in the grassy savannas, males usually run about 70 pounds and females run about 30. There are other reasons for this economy, but I don't need to go into them. Furthermore, let's see. Thus, although the female had to work harder, she wasn't subordinate to the male because she wasn't dependent on him for food or protection. In the early Pleistocene, probably in response to a diminishing food supply, humanity's ancestors began spending more time on the forest floor and eventually moved to the grassy plains. There was a transitional period in which an attempt was made to continue the gathering of food, but the environment was essentially unsuited to sustain large numbers in this fashion. Group size was necessary for protection against predators, which were more numerous on the plains and also hungrier. The next great step in social evolution was to a cooperative hunting economy. Unfortunately for women, it was a step in the wrong direction. The division of labor was such that men were responsible for hunting and defense of the tribe. All other labor fell to the woman. Will Durant identifies the position of women in these early hunting societies as, quote, subjugation verging upon slavery. There's no evidence that the woman was as yet physically smaller than the male. This wasn't the reason for her subjugation at this point. It was because she was tied inextricably to reproduction. She was responsible for rearing children, gathering the food, cooking, clothing manufacture and repair, probably home erection, and undoubtedly repair of the shelter. She was also the principal beast of burden. When the group moved, the men had to be prepared to fight off attacks at any moment so they could not be encumbered. This identification of the woman as the one who carries things is so strong in hunting societies that it was reported that when the bushmen along the Lower Murray in Australia first saw pack oxen, they thought that these were the wives of white men. Furthermore, since she was dependent on the man for food, her social position declined. She had no recourse but to allow herself to be exploited. Even though the man's role in reproduction could usually be identified at this stage, at least it can in primitive societies that we know about that are in the hunting economy stage. The children still belonged to the woman, and the woman was not accountable to any one man, but to all. The only advantage to this system was that she could obtain social and perhaps material support from her sisters, but of course they had children of their own to look after. While the men were busy cleaning their weapons, women were preparing the way for the next social revolution. The crafts that they invented were later to become trades and still later industries. Women developed spinning, weaving, basketry, pottery, and woodworking. They're almost always credited with the domestication of animals, and agriculture certainly was developed by them as an alternative to food gathering. I have a fantasy about the scene when agriculture was discovered. I imagine these two women out there, you know, looking for the nuts and berries, and this one woman says to another, hey, Mabel, you remember last year when we dropped a batch of blackberry seeds out here? Well, look, we got blackberries this year. You know, why don't we do this closer to camp? agriculture developed naturally out of the work they were doing already, just like the other crafts did. No doubt it seemed like a good idea at the time. By planting seeds, they wouldn't have to go traipsing all over the countryside, worrying about the kids back at camp. And besides, you never know who you're going to run into out on the savannas. What's more, a continued food supply would mean that they could stop moving around so much. No more carrying around all the kids in that junk from place to place while the men just stood around carrying their spears and looking sexy. When they invented agriculture, women made one mistake. They were too successful. As domesticated animals and agricultural products became more rewarding and important in the life of the group, hunting became more superfluous. Men gradually took over agricultural functions. Woman's repeated confinements and constant child care responsibilities effectively precluded her from competing with the male for this job. With the stability of agriculture came the development of property. Previously, possessions had been a liability. They simply could not be carried from one place to another. The growth of transmissible property in cattle and in the products of the soil led to the sexual subordination of woman. For the male now demanded from her that fidelity which he thought would enable him to pass on his accumulations to children, presumably his own. The development of the concept of property, along with the patriarchy which men were now able to assert through control of the economic resources, was ruinous to the position of women. Woman became the property of the male. First, as a child, she belonged to her father, later to her husband. Property can be bought or sold and treated as the owner sees fit. The double standard was developed at this time. Women were expected to be chaste before marriage and faithful afterwards. The only constraint placed upon men was the outrage of other men upon learning that their property had been violated. The only thing that differentiated the position of woman from that of slaves was that women were expected to provide sexual as well as economic satisfaction. That's a little bit arbitrary. A lot of slaves were, too. This state of affairs persisted with minor variations until the Industrial Revolution. Although the woman was always subjugated to the male's wishes, at times she commanded more respect than at others. In times of war, for example, much of the adult male population is involved in combat, and the women are left to carry on at home. They also gained status by replenishing the depleted population, though to be sure they didn't have the option of refusing. Prescribed morality also had an effect at times. For example, it's customary to think of Greece as being particularly an enlightened culture, but the Greek wife was relegated to the back of the house from which she was not allowed to stir. She was not permitted to take part in intellectual life of the times, nor was she even permitted the luxury of a lover. For great love affairs took place between men. The Jews elevated women by placing great emphasis on the importance of family life, but that same emphasis on the family made it necessary to close off alternatives to motherhood. All Jewish males over the age of 5 were taught to read and write, but women were not, nor were they permitted to take part in many aspects of religious life. Catholicism, by prohibiting divorce and imposing fidelity on men also, ensured that women would have a continued economic support of her children. It also guaranteed that she would need that support by prohibiting birth control. This is more contemporary than past. The era of courtly love elevated women in esteem, although it did little to assist her materially because love took place between lovers and not between a husband and a wife. That was an economic setup. The advent of the Industrial Revolution produced radical changes in the social situation. Previously, woman had been the slave of man, and man had functioned relatively independently. Now masses of men became subordinate to other men. This had always been true to a certain extent, of course, but the concept of a job which is separated from the rest of one's life was a definite departure from what had existed previously. The fact that many of the jobs were of a repetitious nature and required little or no training suddenly made masses of women employable also. This did not markedly improve women's situation until children became economic liabilities. At that point, and with the ability to control conception, the lot of women began to improve. As technology replaced population as the crucial element in maintaining power, societal pressures upon women to breed continually became lessened. At present, with our current concern over the population explosion, a pregnant woman is looked upon by some as being almost criminally contributory to future environmental crises. As the means of making a contribution to society shifted from making children to making products, women began to demand access to the means by which they could make a contribution. They demanded the right to work, to the vote, and to a decent education. However, the subservience of women had long since become functionally autonomous. That is to say, men liked having women wait on them hand and foot. If the economic dependence of these women was the price, then they were willing to pay for it. They, the men, had come to depend on women for esteem and emotional support. In one sense, they needed it more because now they had a job instead of meaningful work. The same situation that improved the life of women was made life worse for men. Since men controlled all the resources, they were not quick to grant women the privileges which had been their exclusive province for so long. Consider the fact that woman suffrage took 80 years of concentrated hard work on the part of millions of women. This by no means gave them a meaningful role in political life, just the right to vote. So far, I've talked about the position of women largely in terms of survival. As long as many children were needed to replace populations that were continually ravaged by disease and war, women were required to be dependent on men. It was not necessary for survival that she be treated as badly as she was. That was man's unique contribution. At the present time, when increased population is seen as detrimental, adequate birth control is available, and a productive role in the economy is more or less open to all, woman at last has the means to fight back. The fact that her subjugation to men has not faded away with the need for her childbearing is an indication that she will have to fight for whatever gains she may make. Let's take a look at the position of women in America today from several different aspects. Much of the legal structure still reflects the famous, or infamous, depending on your point of view, statement from the 1765 edition of Blackstone that, quote, "the husband and wife are as one, and that one is the husband," close quote. There are at present over 1,000 laws on the books which discriminate against women. These include restrictions on legal and political rights, laws relating to marriage, and restrictions on employment. In Mississippi, women are excluded from serving on juries and are not allowed to serve on the same basis as men in 24 states. In Missouri, a woman can be excused from serving on a jury if she requests it, but men are not allowed to do this. In Texas and Nevada, a husband can dispose of community property, including all of the wife's income, without her consent. In 26 states, women are prohibited from working in specific occupations or under certain conditions considered dangerous. In Missouri, a woman may not open a charge account without the written permission of her husband, even though she has an income independent of his. In Missouri, a woman cannot maintain a residence separate from her husband, a legal residence. She is prohibited from working in a mine or between moving machinery. She cannot work as a police officer in a town under 5,000 population. I don't know why that is, but the fact is that those would be the ones that would be most likely to hire a woman. She's prohibited from working over 9 hours a day, which effectively prevents her from receiving overtime pay. This is in Missouri. She's not entitled to unemployment compensation for 3 months prior to or 1 month after the birth of her child, even though lost work time may have no correlation with the pregnancy. In 1970, Congress failed to pass, for the 24th year in a row, a constitutional amendment which reads, quote, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." In the area of economics, sex prejudice has consistently proven much stronger than race prejudice. The Department of Labor statistics on median income for full-time employees in 1965 break down as follows. White men, 63.75. This is yearly income, $6,375. Black men, $4,000. White women, $3,744. Black women, $2,642. It's the black woman, the victim of both race and sex prejudice, that suffer the most. Women constitute 35% of the labor force, but are highly concentrated in underpaid jobs. Women constitute 99% of all domestic workers, 70% of all clerical workers, and 55% of all other service workers. Only 14% of all working women are in technical or professional occupations. Women constitute 7% of the physicians, as opposed to 75% in the Soviet Union. They're 3% of the engineers, 35% in the Soviet Union. Women are only 3% of the lawyers in the United States. Differences in median salary are not accounted for by occupation alone. With occupation controlled, women earn 58% of the pay of men. You may have read recently that Safeway voluntarily decided to grant women equal pay with men, and this raised some of them, it raised their pay as much as 40%. For sales workers, the figure is women earn 40% of the income of men. For clerical workers, it's 66%. For professionals, 64%. In my profession, psychology, women earn approximately $2,000 a year less than men, even though a higher percentage of women psychologists are PhDs. Nor can the blame be laid to lack of education. The average woman college graduate earns pay commensurate with the male worker with an eighth grade education. Lower pay for women is frequently justified by stating that their income is simply to supplement that of the husband. However, 35% of women who work are not married. They're their own support. 8 million heads of families are women who must provide for their children. Furthermore, repeated studies have shown that most married women work out of economic necessity. Yet only 25 states have equal pay for equal work laws. Religion poses a problem for women in two ways. It teaches that woman is evil and should remain subordinate to men, and it does not allow women a voice in the policy-making decisions. The first woman to attempt to become a rabbi is in her fourth year of study, and it is not certain that she will be ordained. The Lutheran Church of America decided last June to ordain women ministers, but other Lutheran churches have not followed suit. That's you all, isn't it? Episcopalians will now allow women to become deacons, but not priests. Roman Catholicism now permits women to read at Mass, but will not allow them to become priests. Consider the following quotations from Islam, from the Quran. Men are superior to women on account of the qualities in which God has given them preeminence. From Judaism, from an Orthodox morning prayer. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, that I was not born a Gentile. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, that I was not born a slave. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, that I was not born a woman. From Christianity, 1 Corinthians 11. For a man is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man. For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. And the progenitor of all three of these. And the rib which the Lord God had taken from man made he a woman and brought her unto the man. And the Lord God said unto the woman, What is this that thou hast done? And the woman said, The serpent beguiled me, and I did eat. Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. It kind of gives me the creeps just to think about it. In academics, women are also discriminated against in two ways, as students and as teachers. Many schools, for example, impose quotas on freshman women because there are a disproportionate number of qualified female applicants. Many schools also have more stringent admissions requirements for women than men. Graduate departments have been known to blithely decide to exclude women altogether on the grounds that they're going to get married and have children anyway. So why waste time giving them an education that they will never use? I know personally about, this happened in the University of Wyoming Psychology Department in 1967. They just said, no graduate students, no women. This blatantly disregards the fact that 50% of women PhDs are not married and that 86% of them are working regardless of marital status or children. An even higher percentage would be working if not for nepotism rules and the fact that there is often a restricted job market where their husbands choose to locate. Once they have an academic position, women are prevented from advancement. They comprise 25% of all untenured positions, but only 12% of all tenured ones. The discrimination increases directly from instructor to full professor, where women are 2% of full professors. Furthermore, with position controlled, women in academics earn approximately $1,500 a year less than their male colleagues. The unkindest cut of all, however, is the fact that their work is undervalued. In one study, subjects were given six identical articles, half authored by Joan T. McKay, half by John T. McKay, to rate on value, persuasiveness, profundity, writing style, and competence of the author. Works attributed to males were rated superior on all dimensions, while those attributed to females were rated average or below average. Furthermore, this held even for articles in traditional female fields, such as art history and dietetics. The above does not even include more subtle means of discouraging women from academic achievement, such as repeated admonitions that it is unfeminine and that they will never get a man that way. In a study done of University of Michigan undergraduates, only 10% of the men, but fully 65% of the women associated academic achievement with negative consequences. Socially, women are confined to the role of wife and mother. Men are expected to be husbands and fathers too, but no one expects them to choose between marriage and a career. What usually happens is that the woman, unable or unwilling to give up her job, winds up with two full-time jobs, a 40-hour work week in her employment situation, and a 99.6-hour work week as a housewife. That figures from the Chase Manhattan Bank, which I don't identify as a particularly feminist institution. So I think that that must be a fairly accurate estimate. Or perhaps if it's a liberal marriage, the husband will help her with her housework. Men undertake marriage with relatively few consequences to their daily routine, except possibly eating at home instead of a restaurant. But the consequences to women are extreme. To begin with, she loses the name she has had all her life. She loses legal rights and acquires responsibilities. For example, the woman is required by law to submit sexually to her husband, but the reverse is not true. The husband is expected to supply the money, but the wife is expected to do everything else. Furthermore, she's not free not to choose this role. The consequences are quite negative and range from being tagged an old maid to having rumors about frigidity floating around to being accused of being a lesbian. The personal consequences to women, however, are probably the least publicized and the most damaging. First, although the reasons for division of labor along set lines have disappeared, they've left a legacy in the form of sex role stereotypes. Everyone knows, quote knows, that women are passive, dependent, emotional, illogical. Men are seen as being independent, objective, logical, and able to separate feelings from ideas. There's considerable evidence that women are less aggressive and more dependent because they've been brought up to be that way. In general, women behave the way they do because they're expected to. Women have quite negative self-concepts, and everyone is familiar with the workings of the self-fulfilling prophecy. Traits of girls listed by Terman and Tyler in their review of sex differences include sensitivity, conformity to social pressures, response to environment, responsiveness, ease of social control, ingratiation, sympathy, low levels of aspiration, compassion for the underprivileged, and anxiety. Compare those to traits due to victimization listed by Allport in The Nature of Prejudice. Sensitivity, submission, fantasies of power, desire for protection, indirectness, ingratiation, petty revenge and sabotage, sympathy, extremes of both self and group hatred and self and group glorification, display of flashy status symbols, compassion for the underprivileged, identification with the dominant group's norms, and passivity. While women are principally victims of sex role stereotypes, they do enjoy some benefits. Actually, sex role stereotypes discriminate against men also, rather than providing benefits for women. In the event of a divorce, men are deprived of their children, regardless of which is the more fit parent. Men frequently must pay alimony for years to a woman who's capable of working and may even be working, but who chooses not to remarry. Just as women are forced into the role of homemaker, men are forced into the role of provider and must often work all day at a job they hate when they would be very well suited to caring for the children. It's interpersonal relationships which grind women down the most, however. Women are trained that their value is as a wife and a mother to someone else, but the subtle day-to-day degradations are extremely difficult to handle. Few women are unfamiliar with the phenomenon of being treated like a servant by their children and/or husband. Every woman has known the humiliation of verbal assaults on the street as she marches rigidly, straight ahead, eyes forward, so as not to look at the people. When I say verbal assaults, I mean things like, hey, baby, let's make it. Those kinds of things. They're very difficult to deal with. You can't confront the person with it. It's hardly worth your time. But it's an extremely humiliating thing. Everyone's familiar with the way that conversations occasionally stop abruptly the moment the woman walks in the room. I'd really like to end this talk on a resounding note and see you all march out being ardent feminists and determined to right the wrongs of the world. Instead, I'd like to ask you to do something a little more radical. I'd like you to look at yourselves and see what are the contributions, conscious or unconscious, that you're making to the perpetuation of these injustices. If you're a man, what have you done to your wife or girlfriend lately? If you're a woman, what have you put up with lately and not said anything about it? There's no justice for one unless there's justice for all.
Well, would you want to field some questions at this point for 8 or 10 minutes, and then we'll break into smaller groups for discussion purposes?
I don't really care.
Well, why don't we take any questions that pop up at this time, and then cut it off in about 10 minutes, and
fine. Let's do this.
All right. Why don't you just?
In the honey stages, the woman had to take her own, take her kids. She also did what agriculture was being done at that time in the honey
period. Right. Well, what happened, basically, was that agriculture became more valuable. It supplanted hunting as the principal source of food, which then freed the man to compete with the woman in agriculture. It had to have been a gradual process, you know. Agriculture gradually supplied more and more of the food, and as it became more complex and more valuable, the men needed to hunt less. They were able then to compete with the woman. Okay, well, look at it this way. Look at the division of labor from a common sense viewpoint. What you need is food and children, okay? Now, in the hunting stage, you had to get food by gathering, which wasn't enough, and by hunting. Women had to take care of the children, the men took care of the hunting, okay? When you're in the agricultural stage, if you don't need the hunting, then you still have the division of labor, getting the food and taking care of the children. It's a sensible division of labor.
Well, I'm saying that time, you know, it's a very sensible division of
labor, but at this point, it's really I'm sure there was an extremely, well, there was a period of turmoil, or a period of change, not necessarily turmoil, but a gradual change in which, you know, women said to men, hey, what are you doing in my potato patch? But that's probably the way it happened. You know, a microcosm of this is what happened in Israel. Well, they started out with ideas of equality for men and women, and that women would be out in the field. And gradually, as women would become pregnant, she would drop out of working in the fields, and somehow she'd just never quite get back there. About 20 years ago, they suddenly discovered that they had a division of labor again, and they had the problem to deal with all over again. Oh, okay. Which question? The question was, originally, how did the transition from the hunting economy to the agricultural economy take place? How was man able to take that over from the woman? That was the original question. The question is, there have been women have been religious leaders at times and still are in certain cultures. What is it that determines whether the male or the female is the religious leader? I'm really not an expert in this area. In fact, my knowledge is quite scanty. I do know that Will Durant mentions that when the transition from the hunting economy to the agricultural economy took place when society changed from not matriarchy, but the family consisted of the mother and her children, to a patriarchy, that the gods changed from being female to male at that period. But I don't know about the religious leaders. I do know this has been written on, but I'm really not competent to answer. Would you like to answer that? By definition? No, not at all. What I am saying is that it's there is something inherently degrading in being dependent.
How would you count that if there
that's a pretty big if. And also the question is, why must marriage relationships be structured the way they are presently? There's considerable evidence that marriage is changing from one which is, from a pairing which is, has an economic base, it's for life, etc., to a pattern of successive monogamy in which the primary reason for a marriage is not economic, and not particularly having children either, but rather emotional satisfaction. When you become dissatisfied with a partner, you separate and get another one. You know, it's my personal belief that this is a pattern that's evolving at this time.
I think it's a question of how we keep repeating the same error today.
I don't think that the artificial womb is at all necessary. The thing that was degrading, well, the thing that held woman in bondage was not the fact that she had to bear children so much as the implications of that, that she had to be economically dependent on the male. And people, in general, when they're placed in a position they can exploit somebody, generally will. And that's what happened with women. I think when pregnancy, first of all, women don't have 10 children anymore. They might have a couple, they might have none. You know, zero population growth says anybody that has more than 2 children is pretty horrible. A lot of people feel like it's their civic duty not to have any children at all. That obviously frees the woman completely from that kind of responsibility. But I think a system that enables the woman to be economically independent while still bearing children is the one that will work. We're obviously very close to that now. Independent. Well, that's, I really disagree with that. I mean, my personal feeling is that test tube babies are much more, much less desirable than some social system which compensates the woman for what she has to do. This is the way we take care of a great many inequalities which are biologically determined. Some people are smarter than others. Some people are more able to make a living than others. So we have a welfare system that supports people who are not able to make it for themselves. We have hospitals. We have, you know, all kinds of socialistic systems which take care of people who cannot compete on an equal basis with others. I think that's what has to happen with women. Okay, you had your hand up first. The question is, what effect do I think that the liberated woman will have on the concept of the family? I think that people are going to try a lot of different things. Experimentation is the primary effect that I see at the present time. I've already talked about successive monogamy. I think that people are going to look outside the nuclear family for other forms of emotional support. It wasn't so much economics, but mobility, which has brought about the nuclear family, father, mother, and children, which leave people so dependent on each other that there's no other place that they can get any support or gratification than from each other. They're frequently strangers to their neighbors and so on and so forth. Well, I think that people are going to try to set up some social system for taking care of that, getting support outside the nuclear family. Okay.
We'd like to ask those who have agreed to be group facilitators